You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge. Now, Outdoor Edge is a knife company. We all know that. They offer a complete line of fixed blade knives, replaceable blade knives, and game processing kits, right? So any blade you need to break down an animal, these guys have it. Now, the cool thing about their replaceable blades is, let's say you are in the middle of breaking down an animal and the blade goes dull. The only thing you have to do is push a button. The blade pops out, you put a new blade in, it locks in tight, and you're back to breaking down that animal. You get it cooled down, you get it back to the truck faster, and you get more meat in the long run. So if you want to find out more information about all the blades, fixed, replaceable, and game processing kits that Outdoor Edge makes, visit their website, OutdoorEdge.com, and if you want to save 30% on your purchase, enter the discount code NATION30. That's NATION30, and that's OutdoorEdge.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to another Land and Legacy podcast. Adam is here, correct?
Yeah, I'm here.
Man, we've got a really exciting podcast lineup for this week. One that has taken some time, some additional research, some thought. And I think it's going to kind of settle the score and really lay out some good understanding of just what deer eat, what they're looking for, and how we can analyze it. So I don't want to take up too much time on intro this week because I know we're getting to a lot of really good discussion. So let's go ahead and reintroduce a guest that we've had on the past. So Dr. Will Goolsby, are you there?
I'm here.
Man. What's happening?
You know, just looking at some data on my screen to hopefully share with everybody today, thinking about bow season and opening up tomorrow in Alabama. Got one sitting to stand so far in Georgia. Was unsuccessful, but saw some deer, had a good time. And, yeah, look forward to talking to you guys.
I think it's going to be super insightful for those people who are land managers to really just kind of, in a really big capacity, comprehend what it is that deer eat and how we can analyze that. So I know you've got some thoughts that you want to share on this topic. So we'll just let you kind of kick it off, and we'll just go in from there.
All right. So you're giving me free rein, right?
Free rein, my friend.
All right. So, you know, in preparing for this podcast, you know, we decided that we wanted to talk about year-round nutrition. And I think one of the aspects of nutrition that we focus on the most is the F word, right? Forbs. Mm-hmm. We say Forbs, you know, so often, like we're beating a dead horse, and that's for good reason. They've got the highest nutrient content of any plants that deer eat. And they've got the highest digestibility at the same time. And, you know, so when you have that high protein package in a very digestible plant, it's hard to deny the importance of those plants in a deer's diet. And you couple that with the fact that, you know, protein is the most limiting macronutrient, not just in deer's diet, but in any vegetarian's diet, it becomes a very valuable food resource. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, you've got browse, and browse is what we're going to be talking about, I think, to a significant degree today. And what I mean by that is browse is just woody plants and their parts, right? So when we say browse, that specifically means woody plants. I know it's common to refer to browse or use browse as a verb. We talked about this before we started recording. When we're referencing, you know, deer that are moving around through their environment and eating, we call it browsing. But technically, the term browse means woody plants that deer eat. So browse is less nutritious than forbs on the whole, and it's lower in digestibility, right? But we can't discount the importance of browse as a food source, because its biomass is much greater than that of forbs across the landscape. And what's the other issue with forbs? You know, they're only availability. Exactly. They're only available during a limited time of the year. So, with that being said, and I've got other stats that I'm willing to jump into and talking about how frequently browse gets used and when. But I think the important point, you know, kind of in this introduction, is that it doesn't need to be discluded or left out of the conversation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the thought processes that we had and kind of juggled back and forth is getting into this podcast is you hear so many people discuss the protein level of a forage, and that be the basis upon, is it valuable or not? And, mm-hmm. and when you stack certain plants that would be in a forb category that, like you said, are protein packed, a lot of total digestible nutrients in it, you then compare that to woody browse, there's this big difference. And mm-hmm. it's like comparing apples and oranges, when an apple and an orange are both really good for you. And you probably need both of them, but you shouldn't really be comparing the two together, because they both are valuable.
Right.
And so that's kind of the idea behind this discussion. Adam, I think I was cutting you off when you,
yeah.
you were starting in there.
You totally did.
Yeah, oh well.
I want to hear, Will, you talk about some of the, for people that may, you know, maybe they don't listen to us every week, or they just tuned in. What are some of the, when they're trying to picture, because I'm a visual guy, so when we're early on to this podcast and you say woody browse, and then you talked about forbs, what are some of your favorite woody browse species, and not just, and I'll clarify that whenever we get into it, but not just the species, but the parts of that species that are being browsed?
Right. Yeah, so the go-tos, In my neck of the woods, and really a lot of these species are present throughout the whitetails range with few exceptions. But, you know, I think about most of our vines. So like things like trumpet vine, for example, muscadine vines are a relatively nutritious browse. Greenbrier.
Yeah.
Has a relatively nutritious winter hardy browse. A lot of people don't think about blackberries as a browse, but blackberries can provide some browse. And mostly what deer are eating when they eat blackberries, they're eating the leaves, not the stems themselves. For obvious reasons, they're not palatable because they have thorns on them. But many people are surprised to know that the nutrient content of blackberry leaves is fairly high. And that's a plant that I refer to as tardily deciduous, which means, you know, it does drop its leaves in the wintertime, but it tends to hang on to them a lot longer than other deciduous species.
Yeah.
Black cherry is another one that's prevalent throughout the whitetails range and is a fairly good browse species, dogwood, and a lot of your maple species as well.
Mm-hmm. What about, you were mentioning vines, what about Matt's nickname?
Virginia Creeper.
That's from Virginia, so I always tell him that's his nickname, but yeah.
I did not know that. I'm yes, sorry sir. To say this, Matt, but, you know, Virginia Creeper is just not one of my favorites. I don't see much utilization of it in my neck of the woods.
You had to make it personal.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
You had to make it personal.
Yeah. We got Chainsaw Chad, which people seem to really like that one. I just can't get Virginia Creeper to stick.
Oh, and how can I forget? One more I have to point out, because people who haven't, you know, been in these discussions before or learned about this, you're always surprised to hear that poison ivy is actually a relatively high quality browse for deer.
Yeah and very common.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can find that
sometimes
everywhere.
Too common for me.
yeah
What about when you mentioned forbs, what are some of your top forbs to try to make
obviously
that clear difference between the two?
Right. Obviously, annual ragweed, common ragweed, that's going to be, you know, most people's go-to, the number one plant that they mention as a forb.
Let me ask you this, not to get sidetracked, but You mentioned common ragweed. What about giant ragweed? What has been your experience with that?
I have not seen your utilization of giant ragweed.
And I ask you that specifically because I remember a conversation with Dr. Craig Harper a few years ago where he was very pro common ragweed and not really. It was kind of a, I think in his book, he ranks out like positive, neutral, or negative. And like that they don't eat it if it's negative, neutral. Yeah, give it. I'm not real sure. I don't see a lot of browse, but I'm sure they do. And giant ragweed being one that was neutral and common being positive. But it seems like when we go west, it seems like giant ragweed is more preferred than common. And it's like,
that's crazy.
You know, the guys like you guys in the east, it's like, ah, common. And I'm like, man, there's places where I'd rather see giant ragweed than common ragweed because it seems like they love it more.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've experienced here is that we really don't have much, and I don't know where it occurs in other places. I haven't spent a whole lot of time in the West like you guys have, but our giant ragweed tends to be confined to floodplain areas, and it really has a very spotty distribution.
Gotcha.
And so it could be just one of those things that deer don't use it as much here because they don't encounter it as frequently because, you know, deer – definitely learn their foraging habits.
Yep.
I think another factor that goes into some of that too is the water content of it, because we see it stuck pretty tightly to bottomland soils as well. So you get midsummer, late summer, and there's not much, and it's been dry. That leaf matter itself is going to have more water in it, and I think partly that digestibility and water content is driving some of that forage selection as well in part western that we've seen and a pretty high prevalence of giant ragweed.
Yeah, totally. Gotcha. I would agree with that. Yeah.
But yeah, so I mentioned common ragweed. You know, I think about a lot of the Lespediza species. Mm-hmm. Some of them are less preferred than others. But you know, we've got a variety of those that are out there. So a lot of the Lespedizas are preferred. Many of the Desmodium species, the beggar's lice, are moderate to high quality forbs. Some of those can get a little bit woody. You know, it just varies from one species to another. I generally consider those forbs though. Mm-hmm. You know, partridge pea is pretty moderate to high quality, depending on the age and size of the plant and things like that.
Yep.
The list goes on.
Awesome. Yeah. Hopefully for some guys, they can see the difference now where you get into woody browse. The list is endless on both sides, but clearly a difference between the two.
Yeah, but with the forbs, you know, most of your species that are legumes, that are non-woody legumes, and a lot of times that's, you know, guys don't know what that is, but, you know, generally speaking, most trifoliate forbs. So most plants that are non-woody that have leaves with leaflets of three are going to be legumes, and they're generally relatively high in nutrient content.
Gotcha. Perfect.
So quick pause there. When we're looking at this forage selection across the year's time frame. Mm-hmm. You shared a graph with us. We're not familiar with that specific graph, but have looked and analyzed others of the usage of various forages across a year's time frame. And it's going to vary a little bit from region to region based on climate, based on length of growing seasons and such. But
what's available.
Right, exactly. What's available at different times of year. However, I think we ought to break down some of that information because that really goes to look at what's available and then why they're preferencing these forages and why we need to look beyond just crude protein when we're analyzing forages and what we're calling good and what we're calling bad.
Mm-hmm. So you want to talk about those seasonal trends?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So let's just start with forbs, because that's the one that, you know, you guys probably talk about the most on this podcast. It's what I know I talked about a lot with you guys last time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we see deer use of forbs generally peak in spring and early summer. And there's two reasons for that. One is that's the time of the year where forbs are generally available. They're not available throughout the dormant season, with few exceptions, but most of them are not available throughout the dormant season throughout winter. And as you get on into later summer, they start to senesce and decrease in their nutrient content, particularly like in crude protein values.
Yep.
In addition to that, that spring and early summer period of the year, as we all know, coincides with late gestation into fawn drop, nursing, and then all deer are putting energy into body growth, and then bucks are putting protein and energy resources into antler growth as well. So not only are forbs more available during spring and early summer, but they're more highly preferred because deer need a diet that's high in protein to support those activities that they're participating in biologically.
Yes. Yeah. I think that when you look at the cycles that an animal just goes through and how they utilize the landscape, the vegetation types, the forage, the diversity that's hopefully available to them, when you look at it and you study it and you know how all of it functions, you really, I guess I am, and I think a lot of people are, but it's like, this isn't just natural, it's supernatural. Like the timing of everything, the reminder mm-hmm. of the species, it's such a beautiful design and creation that it's so perfectly matched and timed up that their bodies are in tune with nature and what it's providing at those specific times. And it's really cool to study it and see that forage and diet selection and what's naturally available on sites that are highly managed. You may not, and that's the thing to those who are listening, if you're in a low productivity site and you don't have the ability to observe deer consuming forbs readily in the spring and early summer, then you may not have that observation to understand what we're talking about. But when you have a highly managed site and you are observant and critical of what is out there and what deer are doing, you see this just heavy, heavy preference. And that's when you see, you know, great fawning rates. That's when you see great early antler development, or you just see generally bigger body masses, because overall you have this connection between the land, the landscape, what it's being offered, how it's being managed, and then it's directly tied into wildlife usage. I think sometimes people try and separate land management and wildlife management, but man, they are so in tune with one another.
Right. That
you can't separate them if you're a recreational land manager, landowner who's trying to improve the property for wildlife. It's one and the same.
Right.
If you want to maximize everything.
And I think that these conversations are so great and enjoyable to have, and I always get more energized when I have them, because a lot of times we get fixated either ourselves or in answering questions. The questions are also narrowly focused on managing habitat during the hunting season to maximize, you know, harvest success, right? We're focused on like one food plot over here, one food plot over there. Or maybe if you're a little bit more informed, you also realize the importance of summer nutrition. We're focusing on, you know, summer food plots, or we're focusing on managing native vegetation to provide for those summer nutritional needs and requirements. But still, even in those conversations, we're talking about stand level management. I get really excited that when we start talking about these cyclical seasonal trends, and this is really the ecology of the system. And this is where I feel like understanding this takes your management to a whole new level when you've got that holistic picture in mind and you understand what deer need year round and make sure that you're providing for that.
Yeah. And one thing when you talked about that, like with people, they kind of progress and it's food plots, and then it's, you know, some maybe prescribed fire to really promote summer forage of native species. But then you look at it and you're like, fellas, antlers started growing a lot longer before what you're focused on. Like they were growing long, early in the spring before we started that.
before you even bought the seed to put in a grill to plant it. They were already growing, guys.
I mean, soybeans are definitely a huge benefit to antler development, but a lot of antler development has occurred before soybeans emerge from the ground.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
And so, I did a podcast with Kip Adams talking specifically about that, and just that development is 60-70% already occurred in some country when a soybean has germinated and popped itself out of the ground. We're well beyond that. And this is why, let's say, Atlanta Legacy philosophy wise, we can't steer far away from the ecology and the landscape in our management. If we do that, then we're kind of derailing or minimizing the success that a landowner could experience with a specific parcel. Because if we don't first understand the cycles and the needs and requirements on a daily basis that's in tune with what the property can or should be offering, then we're missing the boat. Mm-hmm. And so this conversation becomes really weighty. It goes beyond, let's say, that protein level and food sources, woody browse this time of the year. It's well beyond that. And if you are a landowner who's doing good practices but missing this boat or realizing, hey, man, there's things that I'm not considering or I'm not in fully understanding the value that you guys are talking about, and that's where you take a property to the next level. That's where you really just kind of you're in a region, a good neighborhood, and then you just start blowing the top off the cap that everyone was thinking, oh, that's a good neighborhood, that's a productive neighborhood. Well, are you doing all the other things? And you see the success just kind of really, really take off. That's fun. That's really cool to be
right.
Around.
Absolutely. So do we want to go into cyclical use of browse now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So kind of derailed that form conversation.
No, it's good. It's good. So, you know, let me start out by saying, I think one of the reasons that browse tends to get a bad rap is, as I mentioned earlier, it's less digestible and it's lower in nutrient content at the same time. And one of the things that we have to think about from a deer nutrition perspective is that deer are foregut fermenters, you know, basically they're ruminants. Yep. So they have to ferment this forage that they take in. Is it like a pre-processing step before the forage passes on into their true acidic stomach to be digested further and then pass into the small intestine? You know, the nutrient absorption comes along with that afterwards and stuff. I mean, some of it occurs in the chambers of the stomach as well, but as it passes through, more of that occurs. So anyways, as a part of that, deer are limited in there's basically this relationship between the quality of the food they eat and the amount of time it takes to digest it. So when they eat browse, these woody plants and their parts, they take longer to digest than forbs. So if your stomach is full, it's just like us. You can't eat anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So if your stomach is full of lower quality forage, and it takes longer to process, then obviously you can't take in as many calories, regardless of what the macronutrient composition of those food items are. And in the most extreme example, you know, there's research from the 80s that was done in the Southern Appalachians that showed that, you know, in years of mast crop failure, basically acorn failure, that when deer have to switch over to any woody browse that's available, you know, primarily in that case, it's like rhododendron.
Yep.
The processing time of rhododendron is so high and the nutrient content so low that deer can starve to death with a stomach full of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't process it in time to get the amount of calories that they need out of it. And that's kind of where I think, you know, browse can get a bad rap. Obviously, there are browse species that are higher quality than rhododendron, but that's kind of where that thinking comes from. Mm-hmm. But if you want to understand, you know, just how important browse can be, and these proportions change, like the proportions of forbs that I talked about earlier. This is just from some of my own research and experience. You know, we see the peak in that use, as I mentioned earlier, in spring and early summer, where it's about 50% of the diet comprised of forbs. That drops off tremendously as we get into late summer or early fall, and particularly winter, as those forbs senesce. But from my data, we see a minimum of about 30 to 40% of the diet comprised of browse on a year-round basis. That's like the lowest number it hits.
So 30 to 40% is the lowest percentage at pretty much any given month throughout the year.
Yes.
It's comprised of browse.
That's right.
That's substantial.
So browse is the number one staple in a deer's diet. It's basically the foundation of their diet.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see it, you know, drop off. Browse will drop off to like 30 to 40%. When would you expect that to happen?
During the spring.
During the spring, when they're using all those forbs, right? Mm-hmm. 50% of their diet is forbs.
I was thinking May and June here, but it could be probably April, May.
Exactly. Yeah, that's going to shift depending on where you are climate-wise. You know, so here it might be April to May is when you see the greatest usage of forbs. And the lowest usage of browse, and maybe shift that a month or two later as you move into more northern latitudes.
I don't mean to derail this, and I don't know if there's enough information, research done, but this is more anecdotal, and it would make more sense as we discuss it. So I'll gotta throw this scenario out there and let you guys chew on it for a second. So obviously, forbs are really, really palatable and attractive and used 50% of their diet spring and early summer. But what happens when a land manager goes into a particular stand, maybe of old field, and does a growing season fire, and now we have a new flush of forbs? Would we or would they observe a change and a shift in forb composition in a diet on a given property, a given select population of deer, if those forbs were made reavailable and were new and young and tender at a point later in the growing season than maybe what normally would occur, naturally occur?
Well, I'll answer that. It depends. Okay, go on, Will.
It sounds like you've been listening to my buddy Marcus Lashley some lately.
I haven't, but I'm familiar. Okay. But yeah. It's gonna happen, right?
Right. Yeah. So Marcus, Dr. Lashley, he's a wildlife professor, good friend of mine and colleague down at the University of Florida. And he's actually put out some work on this recently where he was able to show that burning later into the growing season reset those forbs and jacked their nutrient content back up. To put it in the most simple terms. So really, you know, when you see the use in forbs declining as they senesce later in the season, some of that is a function of seasonality, but some of it's just a function of the age of the plant.
Certainly.
So if you reduce the age of the plant, you set it back, then that nutrient content increases again, the palatability or the digestibility of that plant increases again as well.
So we could essentially intervene with some nature in the progression and development of these plants and almost replicate another spring green up. Essentially.
Yes.
Yeah. You really did derail it, Matt. Stuff. You derailed it because now I'm going somewhere. When we're talking nutrients in wildlife, it's like, okay, let's talk crude protein. Let's talk this. In the cattle world, we talk a lot about Brix levels. Are you familiar with that, Will?
Nope. You got me out of my comfort zone.
So they use this mechanism, this battery operated. Well, you can use other ones, but they read the sugar levels in these plants and base it off of the nutrients available and how much milk can be produced in dairy cows, or how many pounds can be gained in beef cows. And they base that off of the sugar levels in these plants. And they talk about that through that. So I'm sitting here because I have a foot in cattle industry and operating cows and trying to get more gains.
and we talk Brix levels and nutrients in these plants. Then we jump over here in the wildlife world and we talk about crude protein and all this. And I'm like, why are they not the same? We're dealing with the same plants. Why does one camp talk about that and the other camp talks about that? So I'm wondering if there's anybody talking about Brix levels in the wildlife side, but maybe not.
Yeah, so like I said, Adam, you've safely made, you've made me swerve from my lane now.
Okay, but let's jump back into it then.
correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it common to provide supplemental protein to cattle in spring?
Yes.
So, but you know what it sounds like, one of the primary macronutrients that cattle producers concern themselves with is energy as opposed to protein.
Correct.
Yeah. And I mean, energy is certainly important to deer as well. And the time of the year when it becomes most important, I mean, it's important year round, right?
Yep.
But it becomes most important during fall and winter.
Yep. What's interesting and why I tie that together is because you don't see cattle farmers other than guys doing patch burn grazing, things like that. But what you see is guys talking about, yeah, if you graze basically the first rotation of grazing and then bringing back, for example, it's kind of the regenerative side, but they graze cows and then that new growth that's coming up, they graze sheep or pigs or goats on it. And they're like, the Brix levels are so high. There's so much more nutrients in that second level or that second grazing than there was the first. That's exactly what this fire is setting back that older vegetation and bringing up new, and it's higher and it's more nutritious.
Right. And part of that has to do, I would presume, with the total digestible energy.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a net product that is, you know, related not only to the energy content of the plant, but how much of that is usable to the animal based on the structural carbohydrates or basically the fiber content of the plant.
Yeah.
And as the plant ages, we know that, you know, it becomes, you know, more lignified, especially for woody plants, or has a greater ratio of structural to non-structural carbohydrates, making it less digestible.
Gotcha.
And so basically, to pull back from that technicality a little bit, I'm sure somebody's probably fallen asleep by now, but you know, you're making the plant younger and more nutritious. I mean, if you had to go out, it's just a simple anecdote. If you had to go out and eat a part of a blackberry plant, you would much rather eat one that's just, you know, freshly emerged from the ground a few weeks ago and doesn't even have any thorns on it yet, and it's all just young, tender, succulent growth, than you would want to go bite off the end of a 2-year-old stalk of blackberry.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
So,
and I think in a different way, this is another way to explain why disturbance and why fire on the landscape is so incredibly valuable. If we know that this forb is packed and great with protein and growth levels and, you know, taking the deer's physiology and building more muscle and mass and antler growth, whatever, why not try and replicate that again during the same growing season and try and double your efforts?
And that's
great. That's a great window to do that in and have that manipulation of the landscape, the vegetation, offer that again. But I don't want to derail it from also the value that the woody browse has, because they're still eating that throughout every portion of the year too.
Right. And I mean, I think this is where, I mean, I'm sure this is the first time we probably said it this podcast, and it won't be the last. This is where diversity starts to come in.
Yes.
And the more that you understand the, like I said earlier, the big picture, the ecology of the species and how its needs change as a function of seasons and stage in their life history, the more you appreciate why diversity is required to meet the needs during all those different periods.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Matt, absolutely. To go with that, with that question about the burning, you know, you and Chad did that burn in August, I think it was.
Yes. Yes.
In a patch of, I mean, you were trying to set back Cerisa lespediza.
Yes.
And, you know, it was very thick with Cerisa, and you guys hammered it. And, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we turned the cows back and rotated them through that paddock or that pasture. And a couple of those paddocks have parts of that burn in it. And we've got 6-7 inch tall Cerisa, which earlier in the summer, the cows didn't touch the Cerisa. it should be no surprise, other than the fact that the cows are eating Cerisa lespidiza now, because now it's a 6-inch tall, very palatable, very tender sprig of Cerisa. So we have cows eating Cerisa lespidiza, which is kind of shocking.
So, Adam, am I hearing you correctly that you're advocating for planting Cerisa lespidiza for deer?
That is not at all what I'm saying. I just find it that you can take something so bad and change it
absolutely
with fire, which is so good, and go, oh, now they actually will eat it. And the only thing I bring that up is, you know, to use that we change it with fire. But also, you know, when you look at charts like Dr. Craig Harper's book, and you can look at all the crude protein levels of things, different plants, Cerisa lespidiza is on one of those, and it's like a 38 or a 32.
Yeah.
It's in the 30s. It's so much higher than everything else. And it's just like,
yeah,
man, I wish they would eat that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, except the tannin content so high.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, that I don't want to derail us too far from talking about these seasonal trends, but that what I just mentioned in terms of tannin content, that's another important consideration for diversity in the diet, because different plants have different secondary compounds like tannins,
yep,
that are, in some cases, the plants have evolved to have those as defensive compounds against herbivory.
Certainly.
And so if an animal eats too much of that one thing, it can become toxic or affect their other, you know, physiological processes or affect their ability to digest.
Yep.
So again, you know, that's another reason that diversity is so important. And look, you know, everybody, I think, including myself, sometimes wants a simple answer. But it's important not to accept those simple answers at face value and just look for, oh, he said, if I burn late in the growing season, I'm resetting those plants and making them more nutritious again. I should do that everywhere. It's like, no, you might do that on one part of your property, but you have another part of your property that you burn during late winter. So when those antlers do start growing at the very first inkling of spring, you're already providing that protein there before the soybeans are even out of the ground.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And or you're not setting back your woody browns that's going to be available for that December, January,
right,
February time frame.
And so that's when we have to start thinking about diversity and fire returns.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so just trying to, you know, get back, steer us back to that, those annual trends in food habits. You know, not surprisingly, we see lower but still substantial use, you know, like I said, 30 to 40% of the diet's comprised of browse during spring and early summer. And then as you would expect, as summer wanes on, forbs in the diet start to decline. They're becoming less available. They're senescing unless we burn them. that's when you start to see, you know, browse in the diet start to increase again. And around like late summer, early fall, and from some of my data, we see, you know, 50 to 60% of the diet is comprised of browse.
That's substantial.
Right. And
what,
so
very substantial.
As we get into October, November, what would you guys guess happens to the percentage of browse in the diet from there?
Well, I think a mass production is going to
absolutely
play a large role in that.
Absolutely. I hope I'm not putting you guys on the spot too much, but you're getting them right so far.
Yeah,
that's
being
exactly
interviewed
right
on our own podcast. I like it.
Yeah, no doubt. First time. This is why we don't have guests.
That's
no,
exactly right. Yeah. So, you know, when those acorns start to fall,
yep,
it drops back down some, because, you know, it's not uncommon at all to see, you know, 50% of a deer's diet comprised of acorns when they're available.
Okay, what mm-hmm happens if they're not available?
Importance of browse increases again.
It seems to me like it's the absolute baseline foundation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you said earlier. But when, based on different cycles of green up and frost and of mass production on different years, that level of of woody browse is going to spike and increase off of that, let's say, baseline or average of at least 35 to 40% across mm-hmm. the year, but it's always going to be the staple, that foundation. And then each year or in each time of the year, based on these different resources you have on a property, it's going to sway back and forth, but you don't go anywhere without.
Yeah. It's the home base. Like
exactly.
to me, it's home base. When other things become available, they will leave. But whenever yes. that is no longer available, they come back to home base.
That's exactly right. I mean, so, you know, getting into a deer's head right now, if I'm a buck walking around in the woods and, you know, there's so many reasons to fall back on browse. I mean, we've already mentioned a couple of them. Seasonality can drive you back to browse. Mast failures can drive you back to browse. Drought
yes.
can drive you back to browse. And so I'm walking around in the landscape. I'm a buck. And I'm thinking of browse as like my security blanket, you know.
Oh, that's right.
If all else fails, I can generally revert back to browse.
And this is the exact point in the podcast where hopefully everyone's realizing, gosh, I need to care more about browse and managing forest and having young regeneration come back into those stands, because it is the foundation of the diet, regardless of what protein content is of a soybean. That is what matters. Big
right.
deer grow and have never eaten a soybean leaf in their life because
absolutely.
They're probably browsing and have access to a large amount of browse from the time it was born to whenever it was harvested. And they may not have ever eaten a soybean or a sprig of alfalfa or
yeah.
anything else. Woody browse is the baseline, and it's just like you said, it's a security blanket for a buck, but go into the mind of a land manager or landowner, you should be considering that as a security blanket for your management as well. If
yep.
they're going to rely so heavily on it, why don't we rely so heavily on it? Make sure that it is always readily available
yep.
any point of the year, calendar year, and then be managing it to always, let's say, be within reach or new shoots
right.
coming back.
Let's take a pause here and thank our partners who make this happen, the steel chainsaws, right?
That's right. right.
Well, and, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because the average property that you go on, most of the browse biomass is in the canopy.
Oh,
yeah.
By far.
You know, so... And I talked about this, I think, with you guys on the last podcast, probably because I talk about it all the time. But when we manage forests, we are making decisions about where we want to allocate biomass.
Mm-hmm.
And we make those decisions by deciding where the sunlight hits. If the sunlight hits the canopy, that's where our biomass is. More sunlight hits the ground, that's where more of our biomass is going to be.
100%. It's that simple. And it doesn't need to be taken really – that much more. It's allocate the energy from the sun to the plants at the right height, and they will grow and you'll offer woody browse. And you may
right.
need to manipulate some of that growth if you're in a heavy invasive area
yeah.
that
mm-hmm.
doesn't have the same forage opportunities. But you do that on a site-to-site basis. But foundationally, it's applicable. Woody browse is applicable to everyone who's listening, who's trying to improve a property for white-tailed
right.
deer right now.
Yep. Yeah. So then just continuing our seasonal trends, you know, as long as that mast is available, they stay on the mast as much as they can. In the event of a failure year, as we've already talked about, and as those acorns are become less available as they're consumed, or they're no longer, you know, viable, or they start to rot or whatever, deer, of course, you know, peak again in their use of browse during the late winter period. And, you know, that peak is probably more and more amplified, I would guess, the further that you go north.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Matt,
absolutely.
We just talked about this last week of comparing
yep.
the northern management and southern management, and then kind of the in-between where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say Midwest, but that's kind of, we're talking more Missouri, Kentucky, Virginia,
Central
North
latitudes.
Carolina, yeah. And, you know, you go up north, I think it's easier to manage for white-tailed deer than it is where you're at, Will. The long growing season, different, so many other variables that come into play. But you go up north and it's like, oh, look, there's very little woody browse and there's trees everywhere. And most of these are not so good quality. Let's just start cutting trees. And all of a sudden you look like the best property in the neighborhood. And really all you had to do was put some woody browse available.
And naturally occurring, there are, you can find so many different options when it comes to shrub communities available in the north. When you have open sky in timber, generally you're going to get some shrubs that come back. Aspens, alders, choke cherries, plums, I mean, you name it, they're coming. Whether it's swamp, whether, you know, bottomland stuff and upland sites, that shrub community in the northern latitudes is very prevalent on a managed site, or you can expect it to be pretty prevalent, let's say, on a managed site, just from naturally what should be and does occur. Naturally, that area, that region is going to supply what the wildlife need, which is a heavier component of woody browse available. Therefore, lots of shrubs are available.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I mean, also even down here, the general trend we see in some of the research that I've done that I talked about in a much greater level of detail in my last podcast with you guys than I will today. But in even in those areas where we're doing canopy reduction and prescribed fire, whether it be in hardwoods or pines, the first few years after you reduce the canopy, you allow sunlight in, would you guys think, I'm going to keep interviewing you. Hope you don't mind. Would you guys think, this is the easy one, this is softball, total biomass of deer forage for those first few years after you reintroduce sunlight to the ground is greater in stands that are thinned only or stands that are thinned and burned?
Thinned and burned.
Total biomass.
I'm going thinned and burned. Well, if you're burning, you're going to reduce
it. You're reducing
biomass.
It, so just thinned.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
just
right.
Thinned. But the quality is probably better thinned and burned.
And I think
so, yeah, this is when we get into the conversation about quality and quantity.
Right on. So what's that time frame that you're saying after years following? Are we talking to 3 years? Are we talking up to five? What?
Yeah, like those first, you know, 3, 4, 5 years after the canopy is reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just thinned.
So if you're just looking, at total biomass, it's going to be greatest in the areas that were just thinned, because, you know, what do we use fire to do? Generally, we're trying to decrease woody and increase herbaceous, right?
Right.
We're trying to increase forbs and grasses. So
fire
is very effective at reducing woody browse. So when you do that and you leave the forbs behind, sure, the forbs are higher quality for summer forage, but you have reduced the biomass.
Yeah,
sure.
But then I just had this conversation with one of my graduate students the other day. Shout out to Dylan. You know, we were talking about his data set that shows exactly this. And you know, the point that I made to him, because he was kind of thinking along this line, he's like, well, if you just want to maximize biomass, you know, you probably shouldn't burn. And I said, what's going to happen?
Yes.
10 years down the road, what's the biomass in that stand going to look like? It's going to increase in height, right? That biomass is going to start moving.
Accessibility.
Yeah, it's going to start moving back up towards the sunlight. And then it's no longer in a deer's reach. So just because fire in the short term reduces overall biomass of deer forage, if you want to keep that forage within a deer's reach, it is required.
Yes.
Did we lose him?
No, I'm here.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I must have. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. I thought
you lost you there for a second. No, it's 100% required. You have to go back and intervene. And that's what I think is lost. Everyone, you know, has this manipulation of maybe a timber harvest or some sort of intervention of a forest stand improvement project. And they're like, great, that's wonderful. They see benefits for the next following years. And then it just reverts back into what it was. Maybe it's just a shorter height. And so there has to be a consistent intervention and disturbance, and fire is that wonderful tool that can achieve that.
Yeah.
But let's say you take a 100-acre stand that you've thinned, and you can then further break it up. You don't have to apply fire at the same interval or at the same disturbance level across the whole 100 acres. You could do a 40-acre chunk and then maybe a 30-acre chunk and then another 30-acre chunk. And maybe at the 130, you do after thinning, you introduce fire 2 years time frame, then another portion of that 100 acres, you do 4 years. And then now you just got this further manipulation of the plant communities, the vegetation heights and structures,
yes,
all across this 100-acre block that was or could have been managed in a simple one-time disturbance that all would have regenerated at the exact same rate.
Right. And that's exactly the approach that I take when I'm working with landowners and trying to help them figure out how to set up the property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at, as far as managing the uplands, down here with the length of the growing season that we have and the amount of precipitation we get every year, usually my baseline fire return interval for managing for deer forage and cover is going to be somewhere around 3 years, fire every 3 years. But I oftentimes block, so I'll burn most of the area on that fire return interval, but then I'll choose, you know, like 30 to 40% of those areas that are going to be burned. And then I'm going to designate those as areas where I'm going to do a little bit more frequent fire with the intent of managing those areas for more forbs, for more summer nutrition. So, and that's not to say that I don't have forbs at all in the areas with a 3 year return interval. I still do, but I also have browse there and I also have soft mast to there.
Right. Absolutely. I just don't think that, well, and we talked about it last week on the podcast too, and I had texted you. I was down in Georgia working with Frank, and that site specifically is doing larger timber management blocks, but not going back and further breaking up that rotation and disturbance. And so there are big chunks. It was like, okay, we have disturbance present on the property, but that follow-up management just kind of continued the typical timber type rotation. So someone would have said and looked at the place and said, wow, that looks diverse. And it is from the stages of some regeneration, but when you're taking, this was a larger property, but when you're taking 100 or 200 acre type blocks and doing these massive harvests, that's still a big 200 acre block from a wildlife standpoint that can further be broken up to increase the diversity within that 200 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And changing, manipulating core areas and offering, you know, maybe it's preferred brooding cover or just more a higher forb component in that 200 acre stand is extremely valuable for wildlife. That's kind of marrying, let's say, production timber management into a wildlife-minded property who still wants to have timber value on the property and manage it and achieve harvest on a semi, you know, type rotation of harvest.
Right. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Are there any other, let's say, annual forage that we need to discuss in like the cycle of a year here? You know, I know some things we haven't talked about, like soft mast prevalence or sedges, how they might play into it or funguses might play into the diet. So that most of those three categories are very small potatoes.
Yeah, they are small. I mean, we do, just to give a little bit of credit to those, they still are worthy of some discussion. But they are a relatively minor component of the diet. You know, we see peaks in use of mushrooms, you know, around late summer, early fall. And, you know, while they may represent a relatively small proportion of the diet, you know, part of that is because they're so highly digestible. A lot of the ways we study deer food habits, it's difficult to detect how much of that a deer is eating. I mean, I know that, like, you guys have probably seen this too. You know, I've sat there in turkey season in spring, and had a deer come up and watched them eat mushrooms in front of me. That's typically when I've seen it. But yeah, they definitely use mushrooms. It's hard to determine really the importance of their diet. They're really, you know, mushrooms are, I think it's, gosh, I'm going to mess this up. Somebody's going to call me out. They're high in either calcium or phosphorus. I can't remember which one. So that can be an important component. I think it's phosphorus. Like I said, somebody will call me out if I am wrong. So that micronutrient can be important. We also see, you know, one thing that I think is interesting is we see peaks in mast usage kind of in early summer and then again in fall. So everybody knows what the major peak in mast usage is in fall. It's acorns, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's also some soft mast, particularly in the south, like muscadines and persimmons are a huge component of deer diets in the early fall. And those fall soft mast tend to be more associated with later successional cover types, you know, forest and woodlands more so. But we also see a spike in mast usage, like I said, during the early summer. And that tends to be things like blackberries, which are more common in earlier successional areas.
Yeah.
And I just think that's kind of an interesting trend to point out that a lot of people don't think about. And again, indicates the need for diversity.
Yes. Here's been my thoughts. And I guess the way I try to look at a property or look at all these different, because on the graph you shared on social media, you can look at the different time frames. Like there's the forb component, there's the heart or the mass component. Mm-hmm. Then you have the fungi and all these different things, and then kind of the base going anywhere from 30 to 60. I think if I remember correctly of browse.
Yeah.
All those others are like supplements or kind of like if you, the more of that, great. That means that they're hopefully not over browsing your woody browse. They're not basing that. And so like in a lot of places we visit, woody browse is so limited that it's getting pounded throughout the year too hard, and then you don't even have these other things to help take the deer herd off of eating the woody browse to go eat these other things. And you're like, the whole system is out of whack because there's just not enough food in any category available.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a really good point. And interestingly, you know, when I was prepping to talk to you guys, I wanted to go back through and look at some of the literature and look at journal articles pertaining specifically to browse. But the vast majority, I would say probably 90% of the articles that you find about white-tailed deer and browse, they're talking about the effect of white-tailed deer browsing on tree regeneration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's such a problem.
Yes.
You know, and historically in the Northeast, it's really been a problem. And completely altered the successional trajectory in the forest species composition over time.
Yeah.
And again, there's another great example of how the land and wildlife that live on it, there's not two separate things. You have an overproductive deer population and an underwhelming lack of forest regeneration. They're very tightly tied together in those states. So you got to manage the both of those.
I think about the national forest or not the national forest, but the state forest that I drove through consulting in Pennsylvania, and the locals all talking about, oh man, there's too many deer. They're eating all the forest regeneration. And I'm like, I drove through 50 miles of trees that are over 50 foot tall, and I didn't see hardly any timber being cut. No wonder you're blaming the deer. Like, I don't know. I'm sorry, Will, if you don't agree with this, but I'm going to get on a soapbox and say, maybe we should print our emails more, help the timber industry, because there's too many trees in a lot of our country that, like, oh my gosh, they're dying standing. And I'm just like, maybe that would solve part of the problem, is give the deer more woody browse.
Yeah, we're not nearly as shy about cutting trees in Alabama.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's a good point. In that situation, you really are faced with two options. You either manage the forest to increase carrying capacity, or you decrease the deer back down to the appropriate carrying capacity.
Yeah.
I got a third option.
Both.
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I mean, it's spot on. But you, so many people are in those boats, or you go to a semi suburban area and the deer population levels are just sky high, well above a carrying capacity. And there's,
yep.
there's the same situation there. Invasive loads are now drastically increasing because the lack of preference and food source that they offer, because
yeah.
there's no competition from the native forages because it's being browsed out from existence. And
yeah.
It's just a very common scene.
Yeah.
But the people, but there's a lot of people who are, if you will, numb to it because they truly have not witnessed quality sites
yeah.
and sites that are very diverse.
Yeah,
and,
this is and, yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say you can imagine what a healthy forest would look like, and with multi ages and multi species and a good understory developing, you can imagine what we're talking about, but you can't accurately picture it if you haven't physically seen it.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't want to take us too far off on a tangent here, but Matt, since you brought it up, I challenge people that live in neighborhoods that have, you know, abundant deer populations
mm-hmm.
to closely observe when they see deer. And it may or may not align with what I've seen, but we have that problem in my neighborhood, for example. And, you know, it's a matrix of lawns that's mostly surrounded by mature forest.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a close steward of the land or a naturalist, you observe these types of things. You think about them like I do, being a wildlife / habitat nerd. And, you know, you assign meanings to them. And what I've noticed is that we see the highest deer usage of landscaping plants during the late summer period.
Mm-hmm.
And what I attribute that to is what's happening is during the spring and very early part of the summer period, you know, the forest isn't managed properly for those deer to have forage away from the yards, but that time of the year is so productive, like we talked about with forbs, that they're able to come up here and there. New browse that comes up is fairly nutritious at that time of the year. So they can stay out of those yards because they don't want to be there.
Yeah.
They don't want to expose themselves to the danger of vehicles, dogs, people, all that stuff. So you don't see them much.
Yep.
But then as those forbs start to senesce, like we talked about earlier in the late summer period, and they're having to switch over more to browse or alternative species, they're willing to expose themselves to that risk and to come out into these yards to meet their nutritional requirements. But then as soon as the acorns turn on, they're gone.
Right.
You know,
you're saying they really don't want to eat Nana's hostas.
That's right. I don't know. They like hostas a lot, but they even come out and eat my rhododendrons.
Oh, that's funny.
But
it is.
They're telling you what they need.
Mm-hmm.
When you pay attention, they tell you what they need.
Absolutely. And if you're in tune with what's occurring on the landscape and what they are doing, you can pick up greatly on exactly what you're talking about. And it can be in your yard or it could be on your hunting property.
Exactly.
But we can't expect to produce top quality, let's say, wildlife individuals, whether you're looking for older age class bucks that have really healthy sets of antlers, just giants. You can't expect that if you don't have options and availability and kind of, if you will, built-in insurance to the availability of food sources on your property. Or you have to rely on your neighbors to pick up what you lack. And
right.
and most people aren't willing to, on a recreational side, willing to say, my neighbor's is better than mine.
Yeah.
When they're putting in effort to try and be a good land manager. But
Matt,
if you're in tune, you'll see maybe a shift in deer movements, or I'm not seeing as many lately. What are you missing on your property?
Yeah. And I mean, I know we've talked a lot about deer today, but this happens all the time. And I know you guys see it with turkeys. People have turkeys during deer season, but then during the spring turkey season, the turkeys are gone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that's because they don't have, you know, quality strutting, nesting, brood rearing habitat.
Almost a flip 180. Like, yes, deer exactly. During that spring time frame, they get food everywhere, but then during that time frame for turkeys, they're like, it's too thick.
Yeah.
I can't take my pulser because we get soaked, and then we freeze.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Matt, you bring up a point when you say to increase and improve the productiveness of the deer. Basically, you make it sound like we're sitting on like neutral, like, but we could make them so much better. And I'm wondering, Will, if there's parts of the country, because I believe there are, that they aren't even seeing the median of productivity for deer. They're seeing the very low productiveness of the deer herd because food is so limited. Woody browse, the home base is so limited. And I'm talking specifically like parts of Michigan and Pennsylvania and places where guys are like, you know, 115 inch buck, that's a trophy here. Well, the productiveness is so like the top tier going, well, we really are productive, is so far out of reach because the habitat or the woody browse availability is so low that then they pour on Forbes so quickly that window of time that may be a couple of months for most of the country is 3 weeks for them because that's all they have.
Yeah, the first place that comes to mind like that for me is the Appalachians.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, they extend all the way down here into northeastern Alabama and northern Georgia. But that, you know, is a vast swath of heavily forested areas, you know, that I feel like, you know, growing up and like even just going back to the 90s, driving around, there used to be a lot more small farms interspersed throughout that landscape. But you know, a lot of those have diminished over time, but the ones that are even still there, you know, the openings are primarily covered in exotic cool season grasses,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And that's one thing that we haven't talked about much, but, you know, from my data, the peak in grass use that we see during any time of the year is really during late winter. And it's still only 10 to 15% of the diet.
Grasses.
And most of that's just going to be, that's because we're picking up cereal grains.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
I wondered about that or riparian areas of like river oats where they're really young and that they're starting to grow and you're like, I'm not sure if deer really would eat that, but if that's all there's there, I've seen them eat that.
Okay. Right. Right. So even those few sparsely distributed open areas throughout the Appalachians, you know, a lot of times don't have very high quality forage just due to how they're managed and what's planted there. They have the potential. They just haven't been given the opportunity.
Is there much timber operations going on in that mountain range? Like heavy, you know, logging?
It depends on where you go. I have found that, like, you know, a lot of that's national forest too.
Yes.
And I have found I've found that some of the national forest in Alabama, you know, they're doing some active timber management there. But, you know, a big problem that, you know, I dealt with the National Forest in Georgia, you know, when I was a graduate student at UGA and stuff like that, their hands were largely tied by environmental groups, you know, suing any kind of timber sale proposal that they would put forward for, you know, public hearing.
Yeah.
Some of the other challenges, there's a large paper mill in the western portion, kind of southwest portion of Virginia. And a couple of challenges is this distance to that mill, like, doesn't even make sense. And then because the number of mills available that can handle, and I guess the other thing is too, the slow growingness of the timber is so your disturbance and your interval of timing in between those cuts is so much longer on some of these poor sites and getting to them.
Yes.
Like you can't get to some of these slopes or you've got to go, you got to haul over top of a mountain just to get to the one side. And you have to then cut through. If you don't cut through national forest, you cut through two other neighbors, got to get permission to be able to do it. There's just a lot of challenges to active ongoing repetitive short interval disturbances in, let's say, a given smaller area that would say that's productive, that's doing well.
By the time you find a logging operation that will do it, you've got permission to get it done, or if you're government sector, you finally got things lined up and then you got a lawsuit on your hands that delays it and you're out of luck.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah, that is an important issue that you guys brought up, is that just, you know, demand for lumber throughout those areas and places to process it are limiting. And to my understanding, a lot of the, you know, steep topography logging operations in the eastern United States have been lost over time. And that's something, you know, they're still set up to do well out west, and they do a lot of it out there, but not as much of it in the east, certainly.
I mean, I've been on several sites in Virginia where, you know, you're taking a dozer in first just to be able to make a trail on the side of a mountain for a skidder to pull.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Right.
It's difficult. And so that much more time, energy spent to pull slow growing timber off poorer sites, I mean, there's just so many challenges to it to, again, have that frequent disturbance that you can get in a different landscape.
Yeah. Right. And I don't think this is a solution at a landscape scale, but certainly at the property level for the landowner, you know, one of the things that they can consider in those situations is non-commercial forest stand improvement using herbicide injection.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Totally. Totally.
Oh, man. So much good stuff here.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, guys.
Yeah. I always enjoy it. And, you know, the last time when we ended the conversation, I was like, whew, that's one of the best ones we've done. So much good information. Here we are again. I'm going to hang up and say, and Matt's going to call me and I'm going to say, that was a really good podcast. We want to make sure we save that one. So when listeners ask us about woody browse, we can send them that link and right here. So you may just become a reoccurring guest on the podcast, Will.
All right. Well, you guys let me know if there's something else you want to talk about. Be glad to do it.
Appreciate it.
Certainly appreciate your time and that information you're able to share with everyone listening, and just further, let's say, give that fuel and passion for what it is, the habitat techniques that we're promoting out there to everyone, and give more validity to the importance of active management opposed to sitting idle and seeing what shows up on a trail camera.
Yeah, stop messaging me about what food plot to plant. Start asking me what chainsaw to get.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it, guys. A lot of this stuff is common sense that about anybody could figure out. I just, you know, have happened to have had more time to think about it than most have.
Awesome.
Well, we appreciate it, man.
All right, thanks, guys. Yep.